Silence is golden, especially when it comes to brakes. That's why Napa Silent Guard are built to be one of the smoothest and most quiet brakes on the market. Made with fiber-reinforced shims that eliminate noise for the life of the pad, rubber-coated hardware for a better fit, and quality design that meets and exceeds OE performance. Silent Guard brakes deliver the stopping power drivers demand. Available now at Napa locations nationwide.
It was a season that saw seeds planted by a legend bloom on the biggest stage possible.
I still think of 2004 as part of the healing from 2001.
This has got to be the greatest day of my life.
A season that brought out the best.
We're right in the middle of this championship, so we'll just see what happens at Homestead.
And the worst.
And now they're tackling one another and a fight is on in the pit area.
While crowning a champion in the most suspenseful way.
We dodged a huge, huge, devastating proposition that would have taken us out of this championship.
A racing season that was one of the most impactful in the sport's history.
There's so much going on behind the scenes in 04, but the headlines that made the sport continue, I think we'll be 25 years from now when we're celebrating the 100th, somebody will look at a yardstick of our history and 2004 is going to be on there.
Motor Racing Network welcomes you to NASCAR Live Presents 2004, Chasing History. Hello, everybody. I'm Mike Bagley, and welcome into Episode 6 of NASCAR Live Presents 2004, Chasing History. In Episode 5, we revisited NASCAR's implementation of green, white, checkered flag finishes, Jeff Gordon's landmark win at Indianapolis, and an incident at Chicagoland Speedway that's known as the fight. This week, we'll chronicle races 22 through 26 of the 2004 season. Those five races include NASCAR's visit to Watkins Glen. That included the end of an era at Roush and a new one beginning the following week at Michigan. Dale Earnhardt Jr. accomplishing something that he had only achieved once throughout his Cup Series career, NASCAR abandoning a huge tradition, and Jeremy Mayfield pulling off a remarkable feat that made history. But we'll start with a visit to New York. The date was August 15th, 2004, and the race was the Sirius at the Glen, the 19th trip for the NASCAR Cup Series to the 11 corners of Watkins Glen International. Hendrick Motorsports had put on a show the previous 2 weeks. The week prior, Jeff Gordon had won at Indianapolis for the fourth time in his career, while Jimmy Johnson elevated himself as a series contender, grabbing his fourth checkered flag of 04 at Pocono. With practice and qualifying rained out, Johnson would obtain the pole and led the field to the green flag, with Jeff Gordon joining him on the front row.
Pace truck behind the pit wall. Green flag is in the air. They're going to race off to turn number one. I'll almost bet that somebody gets off in that gravel trap before they get around that corner. They head down to turn one and over to two.
Jimmy Johnson has the lead, slides through the inside lane. Second spot belongs to Jeff Gordon. He's feeling the heat already as Tony Stewart is right there banging on the back bumper. Then five car lengths back to Dale Earnhardt Jr. Side by side, Matt Kenseth and Elliott Sadler. They go wheel to wheel. Sadler will take the number five spot as they crest the hill and head for the back straightaway.
Jeff Gordon would make quick time of Jimmy Johnson as he surged to the lead, but the man with the car to beat was Tony Stewart.
Up front, it is Jeff Gordon. He leads the way. Tony Stewart is right there. He takes a look to the inside. Tony Stewart wants the lead in turn 10. He will take it away from Jeff Gordon. Stewart out front. Gordon back to second. Then it's Jimmy Johnson and Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Tony Stewart didn't waste any time in asserting this fact that he had a very strong race car and was willing to shove it out there. And right now, he grabs the lead, pulls away a couple of car lengths on Jeff Gordon as they head back to number one.
Tony paced the pack for most of the day, leading 46 of the scheduled 90 laps. Besides a late race surge from road course ace Ron Fellows, who started dead last, Stewart not only had to battle the field, but was fending off cramps and a sickness throughout the day. The situation was so concerning that Boris Said was on standby in case Tony couldn't finish the race. Illness wasn't enough to keep smoke from claiming the checkered flag.
Tony Stewart, one final time off of turn number nine. All that's left now is two turns and a handful of gear shifts. Tony Stewart still continues to lead by some 15 car lengths over Ron Fellows. Under braking, Tony Stewart through turn 10, headed to turn 11 and the checkered flag.
Earlier in today's race, they said he had a sick stomach, had some cramps in his legs. I'll bet he's feeling good now as he comes to the start-finish line and will pick up the victory in the Sirius at the Glen. His second second NASCAR Nextel Cup win of 2004 after winning several weeks ago at Chicagoland Speedway. Tony Stewart gets the win.
Celebration begins down here. There were some grim faces just about an hour and a half ago when they thought Tony Stewart was going to have to get out of the race car and all the track position that they'd have to give up. Greg Zipadelli, Jimmy Makar, the general manager on the team. Jimmy comes down. Jimmy, these guys were awfully disappointed when they thought Tony was going to have to get out of the car. How close was he to getting out?
I tell you, it was really close. Tony had an upset stomach. Stomach was really bothering him. But as good as the car was, the guys had a great car for him to drive today. And it, I think it, he realized that if he got out, he's going to give up a chance of winning the race. So he just sucked it up and did what he had to do. So it's pretty impressive for him to do that kind of thing and do what he had to do to make it to the end.
That win marked the 19th of Tony's young career, with a bright future surely ahead for the young star. This race did signify the end of an era for one organization and driver, a man known as the Mayor. Jeff Burton had raced one last time for owner Jack Roush, a tenure that started in 1996 and had led to 17 Cup Series wins from 1997 to 2001. Jeff was the first man not named Mark Martin to earn the organization a win in NASCAR's highest level of competition. At the time, things weren't going well between the two parties.
Well, it really started the year before. We weren't running that well. At the same time, the economy was not going well, and sponsorships were few and far between. And we had been a successful championship contending race team. And we went on a drought, and we went on a little drought about the same time that sponsorship was really, really difficult. So we actually ran a full year unsponsored. You know, Jack and Jeff Smith and everybody, they were like fully committed. Like, you wouldn't have known that we didn't have a sponsor. We didn't race any differently. We didn't buy any less tires. We didn't test any differently. However, it was a dark cloud, you know, over the 99 team. And it just was hard to overcome. It was hard to hire the right people. It was hard to, you just felt like you were being a burden on the team. And it just weighed heavy on me that Jack and, you know, Roush was having, you know, Roush Industries was having to fund that car. And it didn't feel right. And they didn't want to make me feel bad about it. They were like, look, don't worry about it. We got it, you know. But I did, and we weren't having success. And I was in a situation where I was in a contract year, and the opportunity came available to go drive for Richard. And at the same time, Carl Edwards was sitting there and running Xfinity. And I felt strongly that Carl Edwards could step right in and be successful in the 99 car. I even called Carl when I told them I was leaving. I called Carl and I said, dude, you need to be aggressive. Like, this needs to be your ride. And I told Jack and I told Jeff and I told everybody that would listen, look, Carl Edwards is a guy that should be in this car. And it just felt to me it was time for a change for me, but it was time for a change for Roush too. We both needed something different. And in retrospect, I was right. I mean, it took us a year to get going at RCR. But once we got going, I think we made the playoffs 4 years in a row. We made, in three of those years, all the cars at RCR made the playoffs. We made huge strides. And the 99 did too. The 99 started winning races and got themselves where they needed to be. So it was a win-win, but it was painful. You know, Jack is the guy that gave me the big break to drive for the right team. And he treated me like a grown adult, let me be involved heavily in the race team. And it was a really difficult, I mean, I literally cried when I was talking to Jack about it. It was a really difficult decision, but it was the right decision for everybody. And time proved that to be right.
Jeff handled the situation delicately and with diplomacy as he transitioned to an organization that had wanted him in the fold for quite some time.
You know, it really started with Dale. You know, Dale Sr. started it years before, talking to me about the possibility of, when he retired, the possibility of me replacing him at the three. We had a very frank conversation about it in Daytona. We had another conversation about it later. That's really where it started years before. And then Richard probably had always let me know. You know, he'd always let me know, hey, if there's ever an opportunity. He never did anything inappropriate. He never tried to do anything that was, you know, outside of a contract. He just was, hey, if you ever have an opportunity, I'd love to be part of this program. And so then when he reached back out, it was at a time where, you know, we could talk and we could make a change if needed. And I spent some time talking to Richard and spent some time talking to Roush too. You know, it wasn't like I just walked in the door, you know, and said, hey, I'm leaving. It was over some discussions. So, yeah, I mean, it was a new lease on energy for me. I do remember Russell Branham worked for me at the time. He now is at Talladega. He and my wife, we were having our kind of final meeting about what my decision was going to be. And I told both of them, I said, I don't want to hear anything from either one of you about the 99 kicking our ass next year, because the 99 is going to kick our ass next year. And I don't want to listen. I'm not listening to it. I'm not getting on the airplane, going home, seeing you two pouting. I'm not dealing with it on a Monday morning. I'm not, because they're going to kick our ass next year. It's going to take a year and a half to get this thing where it needs to be. And it did. It took a year and a half. But I was very clear to both of them. I wasn't listening to it. Didn't want any part of the negativity. I knew what was coming because I knew Carl was really good, and I knew that team was building. I knew the changes we were making were good, but it was just time.
Even though the move seemed to make sense for both parties, it wasn't easy for Jeff to say goodbye.
It's always difficult to know when to do something different. When things are going terribly, it's easier, right? You know, I'm a loyal guy, and was especially to Jack Roush. And he had done everything he had ever told me he was going to do and more. And so coming to that realization had a lot of it to do with an opportunity. You know, if Richard Childress hadn't have called and said, hey, I'd like you to drive my car, and also done it in a way that I was more than just a driver, because that was my strength, helping build the race team, helping be involved. You know, Jeff Gordon's a better race car driver than I was, but I was pretty damn hard worker. And so Richard gave me an opportunity to do what I thought I could do best and help build RCR back. And at the same time, I felt like the guy that deserved the next cup ride was getting in the 99. So I really thought that it was a win for everybody. And I know some people, you know, would say, well, why do you care about the 99 and Roush? Because without them, I'm not having this decision to make. And I was extremely, and to this day, I'm extremely loyal to Jack. You know, but it's hard anytime you make a change. But that whole year was about change, right? And this just added to it.
The dynamic of the team was solid, though. Burton's departure had nothing to do with the culture of the organization, as Greg Biffle recalls how close their team was and the fact they all had the same goal going into 04.
It was a pretty neat dynamic, really. And, you know, we're all fighting to be, you know, the best and get the team, you know, winning back in its winning ways. You know, we wanted Jack to have his first, you know, cup title. Those were fun years. I mean, you look back at it and, you know, having the knowledge of having Jeff Burton as a teammate, Mark Martin as a teammate, the wealth of Matt Kenseth, just the amount of knowledge that those guys had and the camaraderie we had around our organization was like no other.
And just like that, an era ended, and a new one will begin the very next week at Michigan International Speedway. For the second straight week, weather impacted practice and qualifying, so the owner standings would decide the starting lineup, leaving Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson to lead the field to the green flag. The day would come to an early end for Jimmy, though. Engine troubles would plague him and his team just 81 laps in. An organization that was having an opposite afternoon than Johnson's was Roush Racing.
Greg Biffle's red and yellow Ford on the back stretch looks to the inside of Scott Wimmer's lap machine. He will just stay in line. He follows Wimmer off the end of the back straightaway. Greg Biffle down low in corner number four heads for the checkered flag.
Greg Biffle in commanding style here today with an 8-second lead over Mark Martin comes home to pick up the win in the GFS Marketplace 400. He becomes the 11th different winner in the 2004 season and again scores his first victory of the 2004 year.
That win was what Biffle says was the turning point for him and his career.
The struggles that we had at Roush Racing at that time to get to victory lane. I won in 2003 at a restrictor plate track. And, you know, the old analogy that anybody can win at a restrictor plate track, right place, right time, get out front. But it takes a good car, team, and driver to be able to win at a downforce track. And so That first win at Michigan, that was technically, in my eyes, my first win. And at that point, I knew that we were going to be a threat.
And a turning point it was for the whole organization. All five Roush Racing cars finished in the top 10, including Carl Edwards, who finished 10th in his Cup Series debut as he piloted the number 99 for the first of many times throughout his career. Up next on the docket was one of the most coveted events in all of the sport, the night race at Bristol. At the time, and to this very day, fans will travel far and wide to make their way to the hills of Eastern Tennessee just to catch a glimpse of short track racing at the last great Coliseum. Earlier in the year, it was Kurt Busch who conquered the first visit to Bristol, but wouldn't be able to duplicate that success the second time around. With the stage set, like he did over and over again in 2004, Jeff Gordon was on the front row and would lead the field to the green flag. A wild series of events would transpire during this one. Three cautions would take place during the first 81 laps, but a major storyline took place as Kevin Harvick started to have his own issue. A lingering shoulder injury would force Kevin to exit the car on lap 361, and Kyle Petty took over for the rest of the race. While all of this transpired, Dale Earnhardt Jr. rose to the occasion after starting deep in the field. In front of a crowd of 160,000 spectators, Jr.'s car chief Tony Urie Jr. recalls what it was like witnessing the turnout and the hype of the Bristol Night Race in 04.
The Bristol Night Race, like, people can't even comprehend what the Bristol Night Race was back in 2004 to what it is now. I mean, when you walk into that Coliseum and there's 100,000 people sitting there screaming, and it's like, it's loud, but you can hear the people over it, and it's like, that'll make you a junkie right there, you know, just hearing it, you know. But it's like, I tell people nowadays, it's unfortunate, like, you get here or there, but back in the day, when NASCAR was in its prime, it's like you couldn't beat the energy of the stadiums that you were going to and being in front of people. Like, it was a for real moment, and it was, I'm glad to be a part of it back then.
Not only did the crowd show out that day, so did Urie's driver Dale Earnhardt Jr., who put on a dominant display of racing.
We had never had the results at Bristol. We had never won Bristol. I mean, we had run second like six times, but never could beat it. You know, that particular race, I think we started like 32nd or 34th in the back, and we were like, well, we got to do something to get off sequence here. And it was like, we pitted early, everybody else come in afterwards, and then we pitted early, and it went green. The race went green. They had green flag pit stops. Well, we lapped all the way up to fifth. So you're sitting there in a catbird seat like, well, you ain't got to race but five cars now. And now you're 300 laps into Bristol. And because Bristol was a lot of luck, too. Like, you had to stay out of the mess. You know, you could be leading and be in somebody's crash. But I think Bristol was our biggest moment of just – and then him and Pops, you know, Pops was doing the Busch car, so they swept the whole weekend, you know. So we won the Busch race and we won the Cup race, and it was just – that weekend, that was big.
Junior led 295 of the 500 laps as he won for the 13th time in his career. It also marked his fourth win of the season and the only win he'd obtained during his Cup career at the Bristol Motor Speedway. As celebrations ensued, Dale would coin the phrase, "It's Bristol, baby," on NBC's coverage, which is still used and advertised to this very day. With two races remaining in the regular season and the chase right around the corner, tension began to rise as opportunities were dwindling for drivers on the outside looking in. Jeremy Mayfield, Casey Kane, and Elliott Sadler were all within striking distance, so a strong day out in Fontana could be the difference in what could be a postseason berth. Throughout the season, there were skeptics of the new postseason format, but with there being such close separation in points, this led to a ton of drama and intrigue during the span of races. It definitely got the attention of MRN's Winston Kelly.
And as an old school guy, I wasn't a big fan of it when it first came into play. I became a fan of it about Michigan, second Michigan, and I started looking at, we had two guys running away with it. Jimmy and Jeff were kind of running away. I think Dale was another 100 and something points back. But you could look from like fifth on back to about 15th or 16th, and all of those guys could have made the top 10. And it's like, hey, they might be on to something. Mm-hmm. And we had so much more to talk about in those races between Michigan and Richmond about who might make the playoffs, let alone the playoffs. That's when it hit me that the playoffs were a good thing and the change was a good thing.
Before Richmond, It was a trip to Fontana and the California Speedway. This event was the first fall race there, and it took place on Labor Day weekend. For decades, it was tradition that Darlington Raceway would hold the Southern 500 that holiday weekend. That race is one of the sport's crown jewels, and most drivers had that one circled because of the rich history that's unfolded during that weekend. So when NASCAR announced they would move the Southern 500 to November, fans were unhappy, to say the least.
In my opinion, taking the Southern 500 off of Labor Day weekend and away from Darlington was probably the worst decision that NASCAR has ever made. And I think the people at the part of the at the top of the hierarchy at that time, now in hindsight, would probably agree with that statement. It was literally a slap in the face to traditional, long-time, dyed-in-the-wool NASCAR fans, saying the legacies and the traditions, we don't care about those anymore. We don't care about what you did in 1960 or 70 or 80 or 90. We're a big sport now, and we're going to the big city. We're moving on up to the big time, right? The deluxe apartment in the sky. And the fans hated the move by itself, and they hated even more what it stood for.
2004 was a year that included a lot of new ideas and change, but this was one many people struggled to get behind. In a year where NASCAR's new CEO, Brian France, made a push to be in front of the big market of L.A., Matt Kenseth admits he saw his vision, but this was a time where there needed to be a delicate balance.
Well, I think there has to be a mix. You know, I mean, I think you always have to get new fans, new sponsors, everybody involved, but you also don't want to lose your core fans and the people that made you what you were. So I think there's always that balance, right? You can't sit still or you'll get left behind, but you can't move too fast and leave the people behind that got you there either. So I don't know. I'm certainly not smart enough to figure out, you know, schedules and tracks and everything else that was going on. I mean, I really feel like, I think 2004 was, you know, Brian's first year in charge. And I really think he did a lot of things just to put his stamp on it, right? To move on and be like, hey, I'm the guy now, not my dad, or my grandpa before that. And I'm going to run this thing, you know, the way I see fit and try to move it forward in the future. So I think a lot of that was him trying to make some big changes, if I had to guess, just to kind of, you know, put his stamp on it. And, you know, now that he's the guy, you know, he's going to conform it to what he wants it to look like.
Brian France and NASCAR received a lot of scrutiny for this decision. And looking back, Mike Helton, NASCAR's president at the time, didn't have a good explanation on why that move was a good thing, even though it took tradition for granted.
It didn't seem right to people in the Southeast, and I understand that. But as we are trying to build NASCAR as a national brand, it gave us the opportunity to do that on the West Coast. Now, as it worked out, we came back to Darlington. We came back home. It's like you say, you know, you stick around long enough, you're going to see the change go as far out as it'll go, and then it's going to come right back like a ping pong ball or a bat, whatever that ball was, got the rubber on the ball and the paddle ball. But we ended up coming back home. But I remember when we made that announcement, and I had to do a lot of things that I knew, because I was a fan, that fans were going to take personal. And they took that real personal. And I remember Tom Higgins, his simple question was, how do you feel about changing tradition? And I thought for a second, and I had no good answer. My only answer was, well, we're starting a new one. But that was his answer for the followers that read the Charlotte Observer that he wrote for. What do you think about changing? How do you feel about changing tradition? And we did, but we came back home.
So not only was the weekend highly scrutinized for the changes that were made, the Pop Secret 500 was one of the last opportunities for drivers to better their position when it came to point standings. So the pressure was on. And on top of all these headlines and drama ahead of that 250-lap race, Hollywood was on hand, as they were filming a new Disney movie.
We have 43 cars now rolling off the pit lane, starting the first of three pace laps before we get the green flag and get this 250-lap race underway.
Actually, Joe, it will be 44 because a late arrival on the tail end of the field, a little bit of extracurricular activity. We are not far from Hollywood, being just 52 miles east of Los Angeles here at the California Speedway. They're filming some footage for a new Walt Disney movie, actually a remake of an old Walt Disney favorite. Herbie the Love Bug is on the tail end of the field, at least for the parade laps here today. I doubt it'll be competitive past that.
It looks quite odd to see a Volkswagen trailing the field as they roll off the pit lane, but you better believe he'll pull back into the safety of the pits very shortly when they get the filming done, and we'll get the green flag flying and get this race underway.
Distraction aside, the mission was at hand for the 43 Cup Car field, and a rookie will lead the field to the green flag.
The pace car brings the field up into turn number four. Everybody on their feet here at the California Speedway. We're getting set for the start of the Pop Secret 500. A Chevrolet and Dodge up front. Rookie driver Brian Vickers and veteran driver Jeremy Mayfield coming to the line for the start.
Green flag goes in the air and they are off and running in the California Pop Secret 500. The inside line gets the move. It'll be Brian Vickers by a nose as they hit turn one.
Here's Vickers working hard to the inside of Jeremy Mayfield, who slides back into the second position. Bill Elliott wound up down to the inside lane of the racetrack. He's challenging for third. He's got Kurt Busch to the outside.
Brian Vickers will lead the first 10 laps until Jeremy Mayfield took the lead. The event would see numerous drivers lead large chunks of the race, but it would come down to a late race restart. With 10 laps to go and the playoffs looming, Elliott Sadler would take hold of the race lead.
Elliott Sadler looks up at the flag stand, sees the green flag waving, and he is on the gas. The M&M's Ford pulls away from Casey Kane's Dodge. Brian Vickers looks over Mark Martin, can't make the move. The lap car blocks the lane down on the inside.
Racing back into the corner, the lap machine of Casey Mears occupies the inside lane. The leaders all start to file by. Elliott Sadler with the top spot, then Casey Kane and Mark Martin in third.
Top six cars have cleared the lap machine of Casey Mears. It is still Elliott Sadler at the point by two car lengths over Casey Kane. Mark Martin almost getting pushed by Brian Vickers up the back straightaway, so Vickers showing some strong horsepower here in the late stages.
And Mark Martin will take advantage of that push to pull right up onto the back bumper of Casey Kane. That's the battle for second place. Elliott Sadler has drawn away his lead now five, make it six car lengths over Casey Kane. Two more, back to Mark Martin.
As Elliott Sadler approached the 500-mile mark, one driver pulled within reach and gave it one last try.
Kane in that second spot. Here comes Mark Martin again. This time, Kane has a little bit more of an advantage. Almost three car lengths over Mark Martin, and they're closing in on the leader now. Elliott Sadler, top three cars off of turn four.
Elliott Sadler's comfortable lead, not so comfortable now as they come to the white flag. Casey Kane closing in. Mark Martin closing in. Sadler leads him off to turn one for the final time.
Ford, Dodge, Ford in the top three. Elliott Sadler by three car lengths over Casey Kane. Another four car lengths back to a charging Mark Martin. Off turn two for the final time. Elliott Sadler in front.
Casey Kane driving that Dodge for everything that it's worth, but it may not be enough to catch the Ford of Elliott Sadler. Top three cars, single file up the back straightaway for the final time. Into turn three. Each driver picking their own line. Sadler down low. Kane up high. Here comes Mark Martin in third, but Sadler leads him off the corner.
Ford is going to victory lane again here at California Speedway, and Elliott Sadler's going to do it for them, giving their fifth win here at the California Speedway. Elliott Sadler scores the win in the Pop Secret 500. Casey Kane comes across in second, his fifth runner-up finish.
Elliott Sadler has climbed from the M&M's Ford, a wild ride tonight, but at the end, you're the last man standing. Congratulations on the victory.
Whoo, we California dreaming here tonight. This is an awesome, awesome win for this race team. This track owed me one. I hadn't had many great finishes here, and to come back and bring my best car in the shop and win, this team deserves it. I'm so proud of everybody at M&M's and Robert Yates Racing. This is what it's all about, and it's cool to get our second win of the season and pretty much secure ourselves in the championship.
The win at Fontana was the third and final of Elliott's Cup Series career. Even though Casey Kane finished second and Mark Martin third, this was a major step for both drivers as they now sat in the top 10 in points going into the final race before the chase. Martin's third-place finish had him 10th, and Casey Kane's second-place effort had him sitting two spots to the good ahead going into Richmond. The two drivers that were knocked out of the chase were Bobby Labonte, who now sat 12th and 36 points behind the bubble, while Harvick's day led him to losing seven spots, sitting at 15th going into the final race of the regular season. Jeremy Mayfield and Dale Jarrett also sat right outside the top 10, as they were both in dire need of a solid performance the next week. The stage was set. It all came down to one race. Seven drivers were separated by less than 130 points, and no one within that range felt great about their chances, including Kurt Busch, who was currently sitting seventh in the point standings.
You know, honestly, our plan put us in a corner with saving our tests and flying below the radar. We still had to finish like 30th or better. And that puts you in that weird, you know, your stomach has the butterflies, and your emotions are a bit caught up in, wait a minute, we should have been locked in by now. So we had to make sure Richmond went smooth. If we had an oil line come off or a problem mechanically, we would have been out. And we would have had all these tests, and we would have failed on Roush Racing's part. But luckily, we had a nice, smooth race. We got in, and we went to work. We tested almost every week leading into the next week's race. The rule then was you could test 10 days before a race. So now we're cranking out tests at all those final weeks. We might have skipped out on Talladega. We might have skipped out on Loudon because that was our best one. Darlington we might have skipped out on because that was one of my favorite tracks. But again, every week we were testing in between the final 10 weeks. That's what kept our blinders on. That's what kept us busy. That's what kept our focus strong.
The date was September 11th, 2004. And the race was the Chevy Rock and Roll 400. In front of a sold-out crowd of 110,000 race fans, NASCAR's finest would put on a show that changed any doubters' minds about whether or not the chase was a good thing. From the start, this event had intrigue as bubble drivers Ryan Newman and Mark Martin led the field to the green flag.
Field comes down for the Chevy Rock and Roll 400. Green flag goes in the air, and we're underway. They roar off to turn number one. Ryan Newman gets the best restart, gets the best start of anybody, I should say. He's out front all by himself off turn two.
Matter of fact, Jimmy Johnson got a good start. He will slide up there in the second position. Robbie Gordon goes for a wild ride off turn two. Almost collects the wall, but he hangs on to it as the field races to three.
As the race went on, two drivers separated themselves from the rest of the field, one looking to strengthen his spot in the standings, and another who needed a win desperately to make it into the chase.
Battle for the lead comes to the back straightaway. Kurt Busch around the outside of the lap car of Jimmy Spencer. One car length separates Jeremy Mayfield and Kurt Busch as Mayfield slides up the track in three.
Back out of turn four, heading down into the straightaway. Right now, Kurt Busch continuing to race as hard as he can here, trying to secure a spot in the top 10 and have a run for the Nextel Cup. Let's pick him up in that hard race he has right now going off turn two.
Dives down to the inside of Jeremy Mayfield, and back to the lead goes Kurt Busch. Now Jeremy Mayfield trying to regain some lost ground. Instead, he'll lose two car lengths in turn three.
So Ford leads again here in Richmond with 51 laps to go. It is Kurt Busch taking his spot up at the front of the field one more time. Mayfield falls back in line in second.
Jeremy Mayfield and Kurt Busch would battle for the lead again and again, but it would all come down to the last 10 laps.
Eight laps to go for the whole field as they work their way off turn number four. Back into the front straightaway, Jeremy Mayfield says, hey, it's getting a little ticklish up here. Let's just make sure we secure a good finish. He's still within striking distance if they quit running side by side up there to where he can get a run at Kurt Busch.
Kurt Busch comes to the back straightaway, makes contact. Oh, and problems for Kurt Busch. He is off the pace. The race leader is off the pace and down to the inside. Kurt Busch is coming to pit road.
Kurt Busch heads to pit road. Jeremy Mayfield takes control of the race and leads across the line, taking the top spot at lap 393. Let's see if we can find out what the problem is for Kurt Busch.
Fuel, he is out of fuel, Joe.
Second car that's run out of fuel here this evening in the closing laps when so much was on the line. Great break for Jeremy Mayfield. He takes over the top spot with Dale Earnhardt Jr. picking up the second position. Still with seven laps to go in this one.
Jeremy Mayfield comes to the back straightaway as Bobby Labonte is off the pace behind him, running out of gas. Mayfield goes back to turn three looking for the checker flag.
Last victory back in June of 2000 at Pocono, Pennsylvania. Tonight in Richmond, Virginia, it's Jeremy Mayfield going back to the winner's circle as he wins the Chevy Rock and Roll 400.
Jeremy Mayfield, one way to confirm your spot in the chase for the Nextel Cup. Win the race tonight. Congratulations. Not only are you going to victory lane, you're celebrating next week by having a chance to run for the championship.
I'm telling you, I can't believe I got Mountain Dew all over my eyes and stuff right now. Report on it, so I can't see or talk very well. I'm just so proud of this team. You know, everybody thought we were down and out the last couple weeks, and we kept fighting back, and pit crew was awesome tonight. Kitty made great calls. Motor was just absolutely phenomenal. Didn't make any changes on the car, you know, got great cars. Just can't say enough for them. These guys really stepped up this week. They've been stepping up every week. This week was the week it counted, and they stepped up and made it in.
In dramatic fashion, Jeremy Mayfield got the win and was in the first ever NASCAR postseason. The win not only guaranteed them a shot at a championship, Ray Evernham believes it provided a much-needed boost of confidence to Evernham Motorsports.
Then we didn't run worth a damn in the playoffs, but we were in, you know. So that was the key, right? We were still a fairly young team, and the fact that we made it and it was extra pump for Dodge, it was, you know, because you weren't really eliminated at that time. You know, they were kind of shuffled things, and it was really cool to be able to do that. I was happy because it gave the team, you know, everybody who had worked so hard, the realization that, hey, hard work pays off, and we got a shot. You know, we made the playoffs. You know, next year we can win the championship, right? You got to have hope. And, you know, because Casey just missed it, because I think we ended up like 10th and 11th or 9th and 11th, something like that. So it was a huge shot in the arm for us, for the Dodge teams, to say at least we were contenders, right? We didn't go 15 rounds, but we were contenders.
The way the final race of the regular season ended is exactly the kind of drama and intrigue that NASCAR was hoping for when it first announced they'd be making the move to this playoff format. MRN's Dave Moody reflects on how Richmond gave NASCAR exactly what it needed and desired.
It was exactly what we had been promised, but we weren't sure we were going to get. You know, Brian France at that time talked about, we need game 7 moments. We need do or die, back to the fence, feet to the fire kind of moments. And it all sounded good, but we were never really sure if we were actually going to get any of those. And that Richmond race was one where a driver who had one chance only, and it was a long shot chance, cashed in those chips and advanced on it. And I think that day, a lot of people looked at each other and said, you know, this might have some potential after all.
The championship contenders had been decided. Joining Mayfield in the inaugural chase for the Nextel Cup was Jeff Gordon, Jimmy Johnson, Dale Earnhardt Jr., Tony Stewart, Matt Kenseth, Elliott Sadler, Kurt Busch, Mark Martin, and Ryan Newman. Next week on Episode 7, a driver makes a statement in the opening round of the chase, the points battle tightens drastically, and a controversial decision by NASCAR that completely changed the trajectory of the point standings.
We didn't care less, honestly. We had t-shirts made up, says, you know, 25 or 25 grand. I forgot what it was, but it was just like, we didn't care. We were living in the moment. That wasn't going to slow us down if they needed to dock us. We looked at it as, if y'all need to dock us 25 points to keep the points race good, go ahead, because we're going to win more. The whole attitude of the team at that time was, beat me. You know, we were in that momentum. Like, that was a track to where, like, we're it.
Until then, I'm Mike Bagley. For all of us here at the Motor Racing Network, thank you for joining us on NASCAR Live Presents 2004 Chasing History.
Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Underage sale prohibited. Introducing Zone Nicotine Pouches, the perfect balance of unparalleled comfort, longer-lasting flavor, and nicotine that satisfies. Whether you're zoning in during the race or zoning out after a tough day at work, Zone gets you there faster and keeps you there longer. Available in 7 flavors and in 6 and 9 milligram strengths. Find Zone at ZonePouches.com and retailers near you. Own your Zone with Zone Nicotine Pouches.